In fact, I think Metalantorius Valor would agree with me here, sometimes good is rowing inside safety and charging into the jaws of danger to do the right thing. And that doesn't come up at all in this conversation of, well, what's the right thing to do? And Odium Taravantian, he even says in one moment, oh, I'm not here to prove that I'm good. Like, he pretty much openly admits, oh yeah, I'm actually evil, but you should join me anyway because it's better for you. Like, okay. But Queen Fen is missing the point, I think, which is Odium someone you should oppose even if it means you're gonna die? The answer to that question might be yes.
Welcome back to Following Note on a Stormlight Podcast. This week is episode 264, and we are in Wind and Truth chapters 115 through 119. I thought that was incorrect for some reason. Paul, how are you?
Oh, man. I'm great. As always, we are really getting far into this day 9 situation, and we've got a lot to talk about.
We do have a lot to talk about. That is certainly true. Elliot, how are you?
Oh, yeah. So much talk. How am I doing? My brain hurts. My brain hurts. There is some philosophy. There is some crazy magic powers, as usual, right? It's Cosmere. But this is going deep. This is Cosmere 401 doctorate level stuff here.
Paul, do we have a patron?
Yes, we do. As I said, we have a lot to talk about this week, and we always want to start with some gratitude and to say a big thank you to our newest surgeon in the crew. We have Karen, who is on a lovely clear mug. Fun fact, that's not showing the name at all. Okay, Karen, as you can now see, this mug is brought to you by a gift that my wife received. She was asked to be a bridesmaid for a friend of ours, and she got this lovely gift, and I instantly told her, hey, I'm going to use that on my podcast, so can I have it? And so here I am. Thank you to Karen, and for mugs that are given as gifts that I get to steal from my wife to use for the podcast, also a shout out for that. But yeah, we have another surgeon in the midst. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Karen. All right, Elliot, 115 all the way through 119. What do we got going on?
Oh, yeah. Okay, here we go. So starting in chapter 115, honor and cultivation. That's another honor, Tanavas POV chapter. Honor and cultivation in chat. And what do we do about this raise odium guy? Cultivation wants to just kind of do nothing and just avoid confrontation. Honor can't do that. Of course, he's got to uphold his honor. So he has got to deal with this raised odium. He reaches out to all the rest of the shards. Some very interesting bits of information get revealed to us here, which we're going to talk about. But bottom line, all the other shards say, nope, sorry, not going to help. Y'all can just keep him over there on Roshar, which we kind of already knew that was the state of things, I think. But honor gets shut down there. Chapter 116. Is a big one. So this is coming back to the debate between Jasnah and Taravangian and Queen Fen. And it does not go well for Jasnah. I feel like we left her on a fairly strong point when we left this debate before, and it goes downhill fast. Taravangian pins some lies on Jasnah. He pins some plans to assassinate a bunch of people on Jasnah, basically breaks down Jasnah's character and says, Queen Fen, how could you follow? How could you join with someone like that? My deal is better. I actually really am looking forward to breaking down this argument a little bit with you guys. But at the end of it, Queen Fen accepts the deal with Odium Taravangian, and Jasnah is left pretty broken and questioning a lot of her beliefs. Chapter 117, is back to Zeth in flashback. He's been defeated. Well, he kind of stood down when faced with his father. So surprise, surprise, his father shows up and is the bondsmith honor bearer and says, no, Zeth, you got to stand down. So he does. And the other honor bearers, along with Naturo, decide to name Zeth Truthless. This is the scene where he gets named Truthless and sent off to do his penance as a truthless guy. Chapter 119, I still have two more chapters to go. Chapter 119 has a scene where Venli is riding into combat against Sigzil's army on the Shattered Plains. Venli is on Chasm Fiends, but it's all a little bit of staged because Venli has made a deal with Sigzil. So they're like pretending to smash things, and they're eating the Chasm Fiends are eating the corpses of already dead soldiers as opposed to like live soldiers. Still not 100% sure what all is going on over there with their plans. They haven't really revealed to us what the plan is, but it seems to be going to plan, kind of, sort of. Then we jump over to Shallan, who is in the spiritual realm. She gets sucked into a vision where Marais is just kind of chilling on the top of a dead Chasm Fiend, Great Shell kind of thing, and they have a little chat. We jump over to Sigzil, and he's retreating from Venli attacking him with Chasm Fiends. He successfully retreats until Moash arrives. And that's all I'm going to say right now. We're going to talk more about that. Goes back to Venli, all in chapter 118, and Venli is just kind of reminiscing on, okay, that went pretty well. Oh, and I've got this package of papers that Sigzil left for me. What is the package of papers? All very kind of mysterious. Chapter 119, we jump over to Adolin. Adolin is trying to rest from battle. He's injured now, so he's not on the front lines, and he's playing towers with Yonagon and Mei. They talk a little bit about, you know, the strategy of battle and all that kind of stuff. Middle of chapter 119 is back with Shallan and Marais as they talk a little bit more about their kind of tete-a-tete and going back and forth between the two of them. What are their objectives? What are they going to do? And then we close out 119 with Nail dropping a little bit of a bomb on us. He says that the voice is not an unmade and that instead it is Ishar the Herald who has taken part of Odium's perpendicularity and taken some of that power unto himself and is doing something with that, maybe.
Yeah, I completely forgot about that part until you mentioned it. Oh boy, we got so much to cover. Paul, do you have two words out of all that?
I do have two words, and this is a little challenging, but my two words go together, and I just decided to choose tipped scales. I feel like the not scales like a reptile has scales, but like the balancing scales, and I feel like as we're approaching the end of the book, we're starting to get this situation where the scales may be tipping toward Odium's favor. It seems very menacing and daunting. The main example, the main reason why I chose that is for our conversations we'll talk about with Yasna, Queen Fen, and Odium. Last week when we talked about this, I kind of left with like, I'm not very convinced that I don't think anyone, including the reader here, would be convinced that Odium is worth siding with. And this felt like I got a little more of that emphasis and that push that I was expecting to feel with this whole conversation scene coming up. It felt a little harder to be like, no, Yasna is fully in the right. It got harder to side with her. And I wanted that not because I want Fen to side with Odium, but because I wanted the drama, you know, the drama of that challenging, like Queen Fen really is like, I don't know who to trust anymore type of situation. And I think we got it here. So I was excited about that. But anyways, but that and all the other things going on feels like the scales are tipping towards Odium.
All right, Elliot.
The two words that I have are broken reason. And they kind of go together and they kind of stand alone. There's a few chapters, Paul, you were talking about the Yasna argument and debate, where I think our chain of reasoning that our characters are following is a little bit broken. There's a few logical jumps that I didn't like, quite a bit didn't like, in just that I feel like our characters are making some really bad assumptions, and I'm excited to talk about it. It was bending my brain in crazy ways. And then, of course, I picked the word reason because of Reason the Shard.
Yeah.
Which we're going to get into kind of right off the bat here. But then broken just feels like a good word for where a lot of our characters are at. Zeth, Adolin, Sigzil, Yasna. I feel like so many characters we're leaving in these scenes are just broken. We are hitting the, I'm sure there's like a literary term for it, where the hero is bottoming out. And in this case, our many heroes are hitting a lot of low points all right about now. We need our Deus Ex Machina, you catastrophe, call you what it will. These next few chapters better have something like that for us, because we are hitting rock bottom with a lot of people. Broken.
Sounds good. Thanks. All right. Where else to start? But at this first chapter. Chapter 115, the grand reveal of several things happening in the Cosmere as of 4,000 years ago or whatever it's set at. Our 16th shard. We'll start right here. Reason. First thoughts, first impressions.
I think, like all three of us and probably everyone, once they got to this chapter, who is at least read all the Cosmere. I feel like that's funny to say.
At the bare minimum, read 35 books. Yeah, at
books. The bare minimum, if you've read the Cosmere once. Now, all the people who've been waiting on who this other shard is going to be, this wasn't on any of our bingo boards, but this is a huge reveal. And obviously, I was instantly aghast. And it was one of those where I was like, okay, I have to focus on what I'm reading still. But like, I'll let my mind wander and we'll talk about it more. What could this shard look like? I know we've talked and even joked about some of the other shards we haven't seen yet, like Mercy or Whimsy or, you know, things like that. And, you know, what could they be like? What would, you know, the structure of their shard look like, the good and the bad? And I'm excited to talk about that with y'all. Reason. I think, Trevor, you had a funny joke in our Discord as well about that, about like Reason is missing from Roshar.
I think it's really, if you stop to think about it after the first reveal is like, oh, that's really cool, it's Reason. And then you're like, okay, well, hold on a minute. That means our other 15 shards don't have Reason, which is really funny and terrifying at the same time. I had to stop and laugh about that.
And to state it even more blatantly, you can literally take out of the text and just reorder the words to get all Reason is gone in the Cosmere. Like, just, we're living in a universe with no Reason.
Yeah.
And it sounds like a wit line.
Is it explained to describe odium or ruin? And it's like, it's odium, that God's like divine hatred and passion was separated from its ability to have merciful thoughts. And that is how I've always thought of shards since then, is that it's just that pure one emotion. I didn't think the reason was extracted from it, though. It's pretty funny. I don't know if I can ever trust a shard again after knowing this.
Yes, like literally, though.
Like, I'm sorry, Sazed, but now that I know that you don't have a reason, like, now that being said, I actually think this is really cool because it puts more weight on the vessel. So the vessel actually has, like, so any reasonable decisions that are now being made by shards are being made by the vessel and the reason of the vessel. And that's actually a really cool concept, because you know that they don't have any of the reason of Edo Nalsium. They're making all their decisions based off their own past experience or whatever you want to say that. It's not part of their shard, which I think is actually really interesting.
And I think that's going to be super relevant as we get towards the end of this book, because in this day, we're watching Tanavast like fall apart. Tanavast and Honor are not getting along.
Yeah.
And yet we're expecting or hoping or maybe anticipating that the power of Honor is going to get taken up by a new vessel by the end of this book. Who that vessel is going to matter a lot.
Yeah.
Like a lot for implications Cosmere wide, for all the reasons you were just stating of who the vessel is greatly shapes who that being becomes.
I think it actually also puts a lot of credibility towards why a shard could make a mistake. Like if a reason wasn't one of the shards, and they had all the knowledge of Edo Nalsium, they had all of the reason of Edo Nalsium, I think our shards should make way fewer mistakes than they do. And the fact that they don't have any Edo Nalsium or reason from Edo Nalsium feeds into the fact that Tervianjin could quite literally be wrong, even knowing all that he knows.
Which brings up a thought in my mind, which is going to tie into the next chapter, which there's a couple more things I want to talk about 115, but hold this thought from when we get to 116. All of that, the fact that these shards are only holding part of the pieces, that they make mistakes, that they don't do all the right things, kind of makes Yasna's viewpoint correct in my mind, in that her whole God is dead, I'm an atheist kind of thing, I think I agree with her that none of these shards seem like beings that I would want to wholeheartedly serve or worship necessarily. Should I put all of my trust in one of the fragments of Edo Nalsium? I think based on everything we've learned, the answer is definitely not.
There's a line in here from Tanner, and he's listing off each of the shards. Reason is named one of the first ones, and then he appeals to a couple of the other ones, and then he goes to AT, who, quote, perhaps the kindliest among us, volunteered to take ruin. And I was like, all right, hold on a minute, there's a line. I don't know if it's in Secret History or Mistborn Era 2 or where, that describes AT as like a terrible person before the shard. I don't remember where. Maybe someone can remind us, but that Hoid has like a personal vendetta against AT, the guy, not the shard. So that's conflicting information that Tanner and Hoid disagree on exactly who AT was before he picked up the shard. Do you guys have any Mistborn spoilers, I guess?
I did think it was really funny that we get this mention, and I loved Honor talking about all these shards and vessels and stuff, and I thought it was really funny that he's like, AT was actually the kindest of them, because if you've read Mistborn, you might not think that would be the case. So I thought that was really amusing.
And actually kind of interesting to contrast what we just talked about. Of, we talked about how maybe important it is that the vessel brings to the shard some things. Maybe that's like Tanavast is implying that Ruin completely corrupted AT. Like, was AT kind and gentle beforehand? First off, how did that connect and bond with the shard of Ruin? I don't know. But Ruin is messed up. Like, go read Mistborn Era 1 if you haven't. And we just spoiled you on a bunch of stuff if you haven't.
Specifically the Hero of Ages, yes.
Yeah. Ruin is evil.
Yeah. We get a vessel for invention revealed. And I have to admit, I was spoiled on this, unfortunately, because it's probably like 5 or 6 episodes back. I know exactly when it was. We had our day 7 epigraphs, who I was convinced was a shard. So I went and looked at a list of shards, and there was a name attached to invention that I didn't know. But here it is. We have Chan Kosar, who, quote, travels the Cosmere creating great things, according to Honor. And that's as much as we get on invention. But
give me all that right. Novella, please. Just following Chan Kosar around, creating marvelous things in the Cosmere. I want to see that book.
Yeah. Do you think he, like, Sixth of the Dusk style, like, leaves a spaceship on a planet just to, like, kind of watch it, see what happens, and then, you know, goes somewhere else and leaves, you know, some sort of technological advance?
I bet you're right. I bet he loves just seeing what people are going to do. If you dropped like a cell phone into Mistborn Era 1, you know,
right.
Like, just drop it in there and they're like, excuse me? They'd be like, this is a really funny paperweight, you know?
I'm going to go put an air conditioner on the side of this castle and just watch.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Which I anticipate we're going to see Chan Kosar a lot more as we start going forward. We haven't finished this book yet, but our trajectory afterward is later Cosmere things. Like, looking, our next thing to look forward to is going to be things like Mistborn Era 3 and stuff like that. And I have a feeling we will get mention of invention, you know? So,
yeah. I wonder if he's, like, attracted to technological advances, or if, well, like, what comes first, the invention shard or the invention? Yeah, it's an interesting question. Anyway, there was another reveal about invention, that he is the shard, or it, whatever. Invention is the shard that refuses to take a home world and is the one wandering around. And we knew there was one from a word, either a Words of Brandon or something, that there's a shard that refused to take a home world and is kind of just wandering. I assume this is confirmation that it is invention. Another point against my mercy theory, unfortunately. But here we are. And last but not least, he appeals to Valor, the great dragon god. Elliot, do you want to try to say this name?
I feel like you have to put on your, like, Russell Crowe voice if you're going to say this, and it's the great dragon god Medelantorius.
That is exactly correct. Medelantorius. Yes, it is a rather epic name. I spelled it as I heard it. Was I close?
You're only one letter off, actually. There's an E instead of an A there, but yeah, very, very Latin, very, like, Roman sounding.
Yes.
Face off against the armies, Medelantorius, the great god of dragon. Valor.
Yes, the great dragon Medelantorius.
You can tell Brandon had a ton of fun with some of these names. This is like a peak Dungeons and Dragons type of character dragon name. And so epic, so fun. Love it.
I assume this is our last mention of Valor in this book. But I feel like we got 6 or 7 more than I thought we would, so I'm rather happy. Where is Brandon going with Valor? When will we get to see Valor? Who knows? But I'm quite excited for the great dragon god Medelantorius. That's pretty cool. Well,
Trevor, we might get Valor again, because we have not yet gotten full confirmation of Odium's champion, right? So there is still a chance that Valor is there. So
took a second for Elliot to react to that one.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just saying it's not impossible. We still have a day, and, you know, I assume some crazy things are going to happen.
Do you guys, okay, random side note, do you guys associate a color with the shard?
I did originally, like back in Way of Kings when we were just originally discovering them, they kind of came with colors, but I've kind of ditched that now that we have so many.
I have ditched that now, but I have always assumed associated red with Odium.
Yeah.
Like, I think maybe originally I probably thought of like Odium red, Cultivation green, Honor blue.
Yeah, if I had like the Cosmere Kindergarten color wheel and each of them had a little, you know, face in the middle of it, I'd probably put it, like you're saying, match the moons with the shards on Roshar. And then for black and white, I'd put Ruin and Preservation. I'm not sure. Elantris to me is like always like a tan color. I don't like Devotion and Dominion seems like a warm green and then a tan. I don't know. Anyway, I am really struggling with my color wheel for Valor because blue is already taken.
I think it would actually be red for Valor because I think Odium is actually not red. I think the color most often used with Odium is gold.
It's gold.
That's a fair point. Yeah.
Like red, yes. Red does come up.
Finalizing my point is at that point early when we knew, oh, there's three shards on Roshar. That was kind of how I thought about it. But since then, I don't think I've associated colors to the shards, especially not past Roshar. But that is fun, and I would totally go further down that. And I do agree. I think gold is more the case, but that's been my mental picture, was red until now.
I'm going to go make a Cosmere color wheel. All right. Chapter 116. Who wants to kick us off? Yasna loses.
Oh, man. I think this chapter is fascinating. And after this is one of those chapters, which we've had a few of these so far in Wind and Truth. I've read it twice now preparing for this, including one time taking somewhat detailed notes. And man, I don't think I understand all the things that are going on here. There's some heady stuff here with the philosophy that's going back and forth. I actually thought of a shout out to one of our listeners in our Discord, Gazeboist. Gazeboist, I bet you enjoyed this chapter quite a bit. This was some deep philosophy. I know you love a good philosophy discussion, as we've gotten into several in our Discord. But bottom line here, kind of breaking it down a little bit, Yasna, I mentioned this in my summary. Yasna felt like she was on the front foot in the first half of the argument. We've had a couple chapters so far on this. And then we hit 116. And things start to fall apart quickly. And it starts with Odium reproducing the letter, the contract that Yasna had wrote up with that random assassin who we couldn't think of the name. And basically pointing out the fact that Yasna claims to be all good. She claims to be a champion of the light, of the right. And yet here she is planning to assassinate, or at least putting the pieces in place to be able to assassinate her own family member. And then later in the conversation, it even comes out that she had investigated the option of having Queen Fen assassinated. Basically, Odium trying to point out to that the case that Odium is trying to make, is that sometimes you have to do difficult, terrible, wrong things for the greater good. And then he points to these examples with Yasna to say, oh yeah, and by the way, Yasna, this is exactly how you operate. So Queen Fen, I am the choice that is not the right thing to do, but the sacrifice you need to make for the long-term greater good. What were your guys' kind of takes on it before I share some of my thoughts?
Yeah, I like what you've said, Elliot. So I mentioned this a little bit with my two words, but before this chapter in this episode we're talking about, I was not very convinced by Odium's reasoning. His argument largely consisted of, well, you probably shouldn't trust, you don't know that the Alethi and that people are going to hold to their word. You know, I am obligated, I have to hold to my word and things like that. And Queen Fen didn't really buy it, was like, okay, yeah, but you might hold to your word, but like, you're the worst, you know? This was an interesting attack, but it felt effective to me. It did not feel like unbeatable or unrationalizable. I don't know the word here, uncombatible, but it was, you know, whenever you discover that someone who is your ally was looking up how to kill you, looking up hiring, like investigating someone to assassinate you, that does make you go, okay, well, do I still want to be that person's friend? You know, like that is like a, you start to reevaluate the agreement and the friendship and the relationship that you have. But that is, it's not necessarily, I wrestle with this actually quite a bit because I'm like, yeah, that's really bad. And if I were Queen Fen and this wasn't Odium and someone told me this news, let's say things were normal and it wasn't a choice between Yasna and Odium, you'd be like, yeah, I don't think I want to do business with you anymore. You know, like, I think that would be a natural and good response. Things are different here because it is with Odium. We, the reader, know Yasna does not intend to assassinate Queen Fen. But Queen Fen is just finding out, and Yasna is admitting, yes, I did hire someone to investigate you and had an assassin on standby, you know? And that's probably a lot to take in. And definitely removes that, like, yeah, can I trust this person? No, I don't think I can trust this person. So it did feel like this was the first time I was like, okay, Odium has them in a corner. He's got them on the ropes here. I feel like if you give it some time and then come back, you're probably like, no, this is not gonna, you know, you're still Odium. But like in the moment, that's a really tough thing to come back from as Yasna. And that's what happened. She's like, I don't really know what to do with this. Yes, I'll tell the truth. Yes, I did do these things.
I was not expecting that all three of them were not going to have the correct answer. There is not that. What is the correct answer in my mind of the correct decision for Fen to make is not presented here and is not defended by Yasna. Yasna, as Teravangian predicts, sticks to her the most good for the most people or whatever the phrase is. And by that logic, Fen is supposed to side with Odium, and that's how it ends up. But that's not what Fen needs in this discussion. Fen needs the rousing Dalinar speech. Fen needs Adolin to go in there and get her out of her, you know, depression. She needs a friend. She doesn't need a philosophical discussion. She needs a ride or die, I would never betray you, like rousing speech from Dalinar. And Yasna refuses to give it because it goes against her like moral clock of the most good for the most people, which I thought was really, really interesting.
That's a fascinating way to explain it, Trevor. That's a comparison I hadn't thought of, is the type of leader that Yasna is and how that was exactly the wrong leader and friend that the good guys needed here in that scene in this moment. Because Teravangian pretty systematically takes Yasna apart.
Yeah.
And he
knows that Yasna will refuse the emotional appeal and do it completely by logic. Yeah. And so therefore he knows that he can win. But Dalinar, if Dalinar or, you know, Adolin or whoever was sitting right here and say, screw all your politics and your philosophy, I'm not going to betray you. That's what she needed to hear.
Yep. Yeah, Yasna is way too logical, way too dogmatic in a way, which is kind of a funny word to use because she actually applies that word to the religious types that she's trying to rebel against. The part that I got pretty fascinated with and started doing the mental gymnastics on is I think Odium tricks Yasna and Fen both into confusing their definition of good.
Okay.
Fen makes this decision to join with Odium based on the idea that siding with Odium is the safer option, that the most safety, well-being, money, wealth is even brought up, the wealthiest option is to side with Odium. And I think all of those are absolutely true. But they talk about it like, oh yeah, we've got to make the tough choice for the long-term good for my people. And I was like, well, hold on a second. Hold on a second. Good is not just wealth and safety and food. In fact, I think Metalantorius Valor would agree with me here. Sometimes good is throwing aside safety and charging into the jaws of danger to do the right thing. And that doesn't come up at all in this conversation of, well, what's the right thing to do? And Odium Taravantian, he even says in one moment, oh, I'm not here to prove that I'm good. Like, he pretty much openly admits, oh yeah, I'm actually evil, but you should join me anyway because it's better for you. Like, okay. But Queen Fen is missing the point, I think, which is Odium someone you should oppose even if it means you're going to die? The answer to that question might be yes.
Right. I mean, that's the stance Dalinar's taken over the last at least two books, maybe more, against Odium. And Queen Fen has been there to watch Dalinar take that stance. So I'm surprised that she never brought it up, that Dalinar takes the stand against Odium because that is the good and right thing to do, not the safest thing to do, you know?
I feel like this is also interesting. I really like what you said, Elliot. The concept that you are faced with a decision to stand up to Odium or to go with Odium, and going with Odium is the wrong and evil choice and will ultimately lead to your demise later, I anticipate. But you are promised safety and things like that. You're promised maybe a status quo. But the right thing is to stand up, even if that means you and your nation may die, you know? And that's a hard pill to swallow. One thing that I think is interesting is we are only seeing the perspectives of our main characters in this story. So Taravangian is mentioned. He's named a bunch of nations that surround them, who they do business with. And is like, hey, they've already agreed to side with me. One thing that I think flies under the radar is how big of a decision it is to stand up to Odium here. You are literally looking death in the face and saying, try me, you know, like it is a big deal. And that makes perfect sense why I'm sure Odium could waltz into any other place, most places, probably 9 out of 10 at least, and give this same ultimatum. Hey, join me. I'll keep you safe for 1,000 years or however long it was. You know, you'll be prosperous. You'll have these things. All you have to do is sign this little contract right here that says you belong to me, you know? And people are going to be like, well, I guess when you put it that way, sure. You know, like the amount of guts it takes. It's even easy for us to say this, but if something along this line of standing up for something when it means that you could be, you could die for it, is something that is, you know, you cannot take lightly, and it's hard, even if you know it's the wrong or right choice, you know, that's really hard. So yeah, I just think that's really like profound. And that's one of the things I'm grateful for, is on this podcast, we get to sit down and kind of wrestle with that for a second. Otherwise you're just cruising straight through the book. So I think it's really fun to stop, but I'm like, I really feel for Queen Fen here, because yeah, of course you want to get the safe option that's like, yeah, okay, we'll keep living, we'll keep doing our thing, maybe it won't be that bad, versus the massive risk with, you know, it's, what is it? I think it's just a quote in the movies in Lord of the Rings, when they're going to go to the Black Gate, and Gimli's like, small chance of success. What are we waiting for? You know, it's like the marching essentially to a certain death, essentially, you know, like a real crazy gambit moment, and still doing the right thing is pretty amazing. So, yeah. But I had the thought of, we are only seeing our heroes, characters' perspectives, not everyone's. Like, even if they side, like, yes, I am going to stand up to Odium, how big of a deal that is, not just being an expected result because they're a hero that we're following, you know?
Well, and you brought up something I love about reading chapters like this, is it really gets you thinking, you know, what would I do in a situation like this? Or maybe you can think of like instances from your life where maybe you had to make a tough choice, like Queen Fen is having to make. And I think you're absolutely right. The choice is tough. I said it earlier, like it was obvious she should say no here, which I think she absolutely should, for the reasons I said, but she's also the queen of an entire nation. She's speaking for thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people here. That's a lot of responsibility. That's a lot of burden. And so she's absolutely making a really big and really hard choice here. But I love reading about this stuff, because it really, it makes you think. It makes you think, what do I believe about this kind of stuff? I love that.
Yeah, not to mention, like you're saying, if you're not making this choice only for you personally, but for a larger group, a nation of people, I imagine you'd get some angry emails no matter which way you choose, you know, so.
Yep, definitely.
Queen Fen needs a Winston Churchill speech. We will fight on the beaches. We will fight on the oceans, blah, 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 you know. But she has to get one. Mm. All right. 117. Maybe our final Zeth flashback chapter, potentially. He is named Truthless. He begins to hear voices of the dead. And he is sent out in exile with his blade. Any thoughts?
This was yet another one of the chapters in Wind and Truth here, where nothing in this chapter is a surprise, I don't think. It's all stuff we've kind of been expecting or waiting for or have theorized about, and yet getting to see it is pretty impactful. As deep into the Cosmere as we are, getting to see the moment where Zeth is named Truthless. Like, Zeth, Sun, Naturo, no, Valano, get all the names mixed up. Truthless of Shinnevar. Like, we've heard that term for literally thousands of pages. And here's the moment where that happens. It's pretty cool to read.
Yeah. Just like you're saying, highly awaited moment. And honestly, not how I expected it. Zeth essentially logics and gives the title basically to himself. He's like, well, if I am not this, then I must be Truthless. And kind of puts the crown on himself and also gives himself the treatment that I'm not worthy of being Sun Naturo. I am Sun. And they look at Naturo and he's like, Valano. And then it was kind of funny. But We get this moment. This is one of those big moments we've perhaps wondered about since the beginning of our story.
But I think it's very important to show that Zeth really does believe this at this time. This isn't some chain that he has that's been hooked on his ankle, and if he had his way, he wouldn't be truthless. No, he thinks he is. Therefore, he thinks he deserves the punishment he gets over the next, 10 years or whatever. Hold on. Sorry, I had a very sad toddler at my door.
That's right. So you even see it with Zeth and the stone. They have him swear to the stone, right? The oath stone, as we know it to be. And he's as you're saying, he does believe this about himself. He's not just whatever, I'll take the title truthless and get on. I don't believe it, though. He absolutely believes it. And he seems relieved at this point in time. He's like, thank goodness the stone is going to decide everything for me. I don't have to worry about making decisions or knowing what's right or wrong to do anymore. I can just follow the oath stone. So at first, seeing this, he's relieved, which is kind of crazy, the perspective of that, at this point originally to where we know he is today.
I have a question about the voice, but Elliot, did you have a theory about something else?
Well, I have a theory about the voice. I think it's been a while since I've had a concrete theory like this. There hasn't been a whole lot of theory driving moments here in Wind Truth. We've got a lot more answers maybe than questions. But there's a bit in here where the honor bearers, Sivi and Posen and Naturo, are talking about the voice. And a little light bulb popped on in my mind. And now I'm latching onto this. Here's what they say. They're talking about whether they need to name Zeth truthless or not. And they say this. Naturo, Sivi said, her voice gentle, you know what is coming. You know there are no void bringers, Posen said. The spirits of the stones themselves showed it to you. The former powers are no more. The Knights Radiant are fallen. We are all that remains, and we must focus on the true threat. War, Naturo whispered, with other worlds. And then they kind of spin into where they give him the sword and all that kind of stuff. War with other worlds. I didn't think about this the first time I read it, but as I was going back through, it made me think. War with other worlds is an odium thing, but it is also an autonomy thing. What if, and we're not there yet, but chapter 119, Nail is about to tell us that Ishar is the voice. What if that's true? And Ishar is not linked to odium, like Nail claims, and is actually linked to autonomy, and is a avatar of autonomy on Roshar, perhaps taking actions similar to how we've seen autonomy act in other books. We had Mistborn spoilers earlier in this episode, so we might as well keep that train going.
Mistborn Era 2 spoilers.
Yeah, Mistborn Era 2. Let's go there for a little bit. We saw autonomy kind of infiltrate a world run by other shards, pick an avatar, and then act through that avatar to kind of stand up their own organization, their own little world that they run and manipulate everyone, and ultimately try to take over the world. You could easily fit that blueprint over what the voice has been doing, I think. So now, theory, maybe autonomy is in this equation.
Yeah, I can't dispute it immediately. It says in 118, Nail says in 118 that Ishar has gone and touched Odium's power, tapped into it or whatever.
Yeah.
And My thought then went to, okay, well, that's over the Shattered Plains. We just learned that a couple chapters ago. But what if he didn't? What if it's in Shinovar somewhere? And yeah, Autonomy has a pool on Roshar. Interesting. Or maybe the Autonomy is the fourth moon or something. I'm still caught up on the, why does the voice get to talk to you? Zeth kills the dude way back in day two or whatever. We started getting Zeth flashbacks. And then he starts hearing the voice, which apparently is a Shar. Why?
Could that be a, could that be evidence maybe against my theory I just spun and towards the whole odium thing? Could that be a, you commit an odious act, building up a slight connection to odium, and that unlocks Ishar in your mind?
Yeah, Ishar gets to call your cell phone.
Yeah, apparently.
He gets your number.
Yeah.
Now, briefly on what you were saying, Elliot, I do see what you mean about Autonomy setting up a point of contact, a representative on the planets. But I don't know. It feels like a stretch. I don't have the greatest combat to that theory, but to me it feels like a stretch when we know, especially that Odium has been working so much on this. Obviously, he's the front runner. It could be something different. Could even be both, potentially. I don't know if that's possible, but I think it could. But yeah, I don't know. It doesn't feel quite right to me.
Yeah, just from a meta standpoint, it's really late in the game to throw Autonomy in here. Like, we're familiar with Autonomy from reading Mistborn, but if you're just a Stormlight reader and fourth Shard is manipulating Shinovar, would seem rather odd to me.
If it is going to happen, I don't think it would be all of a sudden Autonomy is a new villain here with only 10% of the book to go. I doubt it. It might be, though, epilogue of the book. You get that revealed of, we face down Odium. Odium is the big bad guy of Stormlight Era 1. But then maybe the kind of tie into future stuff is, oh, surprise, it was actually Autonomy who was pulling the strings on Ishar and is now involved in Roshar.
I still think the Envisagers are Autonomy's seed on Roshar.
There we go. Trevor, I think you said it a moment ago. This, okay, so Zeth kills someone and then the voice comes into the picture.
Correct.
I'm almost a little sad that we're getting a reveal that this isn't an unmade.
Yeah, I agree. And
because that had just all the classic characteristics of an unmade, like capitalizing, beginning to try and manipulate someone who's vulnerable and in a bad spot.
Right.
You know,
like you let it in and then it slowly takes you over.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. And it seems to be very characteristic. And also, I'm like, okay, if that's the case, then where is this last? We still have a missing unmade, don't we?
I think technically, too. We've theorized on the Black Fisher for a long time, but I don't know if we've ever actually got not one.
I think you're right about that. There. So maybe that's supposed to be a later thing. Maybe Brandon is holding that in his back pocket to be like, you know, later in the Cosmere we will see this other unmade. But I was kind of sad.
There is now potentially an unmade on the loose. We thought we'd tracked them all down, and if this is not it, then where is the other one? And I think we did all this analysis like at the beginning of this book because we were on the look for it. I think the last unmade we're still looking for now is Kimoarish, or however you want to say that name.
The Dust Mother, yeah.
Yeah, so I was going to mention that. So we know that Kimoarish is the Dust Mother, and I think is specifically referred to as like female, the Dust Mother. There are multiple instances that have happened prior to this where like the honor bearers talk about the voice as a he. And I kind of was like, 5% suspicious at that when it came up, of because I remember that. I was like, hold on a second. I was expecting this to be the Dust Mother, maybe a she. Now, we could have all kinds of shape-shifting and light weaving, whatever, going on that wasn't going to be a deal breaker by any means. But yeah, a little bit of a twist here. And where the heck is that Last Unmade now?
You, circling back to the Ishar thing, you could also argue that Zeth kills the guy and then hears the voice. Zeth also like hates someone for the first time and then hears the voice. You could make that argument that it's not the killing, it's the, you know, hating
the emotion,
killing Molly, right?
Yeah. We do know that Odium is tied to extreme emotion. I still think back to what I think it was in Oathbringer, maybe, or maybe Rhythm of War, where he describes himself a bit more. He describes himself as like the best feelings you've ever had, the heights of emotion, the most furious anger, the greatest like ecstasy and excitement, like the peaks of emotion. And so I still think back to that, and I think it was a great description. And yeah, so that makes sense to me, of not necessarily like, oh, you killed someone, but like the hatred, the inner feeling, the emotion of that. I could believe that much more. That seems to make some sense. So yeah, so I'm coming to terms with that. It felt like a big switch that didn't, in my head, didn't need to be a switch. They say early, like earlier, maybe what, day four, day five, somewhere in the middle of this book, they're like, we're going to cleanse an unmade from Shinovar. You know, like they definitely make mention. Zeth talks about there being an unmade around. And I guess it's just Ishar instead. We are talking about this. We are about to go see Ishar, aren't we? Like, we're headed to the Bondsmith Monastery. Is that right? Here in the near future?
Yes, but we're going to go see Zeth's dad at the Bondsmith Monastery.
Okay, yeah, that's right. I have a feeling that is just going to connect.
But Ishar showed up at the beginning of the book and said, I'll see you when your quest is done.
Yeah. Like, so we're nearing the point where I think we're going to get these answers and connections that we're speculating right now.
And I think that's actually going to be a surprise for our characters. I think they are expecting Ishar at the Bondsmith Monastery, because I think Zeth has been told at this point that his father is dead.
Twice. He's been told by Teravangian and Ishar.
Yeah. I think the surprise is going to be it's Naturo. They walk in the Bondsmith Monastery and there's Naturo. Now, back to the whole, are these people really alive at this point? That's going to be the question we have to ask yet again as they evaporate in purple smoke again or whatever is going to happen. But I think that's going to be the reveal.
Anything else on Zeth? All righty, 118. There is the twist of all twists that I've experienced in this book, in this chapter. But first, Shallan gets ported to this beach scene, and Marais is chilling what I thought on top of what I thought was a santhed, but it is never classified as such. It is just a large great shell. And I feel like Shallan would be able to classify a santhed. So it's not a santhed, but anyway. They are hanging out, and Shallan's like, yo, we need to finish this, stop messing around. Marais is like, yep, I agree. Prepare to fight me when I see you next. They can't do it there. I don't know. But when we see each other next, be prepared to fight. And then Shallan also notices a rift between Yatil and Marais. Marais has always been in the background of Yatil, in the shadow of Yatil, and he wants to, you know, prove himself. He wants to be the Ghostblood guy. So I'm curious if there's going to be a Marais versus Yatil thing showing up here at the the 10th day.
Yep. Not much for me to add there. It's feels like it's just more setup, more build up to their climax between that duel we've kind of been going back and forth on. So still waiting for the big, yeah, Shallan versus Murray's showdown.
All right. Sigzil in chapter 118 renounced his oath to Vienta and kills her.
Oh,
I thought, okay, let me start with this. I was not expecting this. I thought Vienta was going to be dead. Like Moesh dabs her through with anti-light, dead. Which almost happens. And Sigzil renounces oaths to save her life and warp her and, you know, kill her. And then she's summoned, or she appears next to him as a normal Shardblade.
Crazy twist. This made me want to go back and reread all of Sunlit Man. And we don't have to get too far into it in case people haven't read it, but I was trying to remember exactly how the future Sigzil kind of references back to these kinds of events. Cause yeah, I agree. This wasn't quite what I was expecting, but I'm not quite sure why. I don't remember exactly what it was that he says later that made me expect something different here, but yeah, what a gut punch moment as Moash appears. Man, so many of these Moash scenes throughout all these books are just punch to the gut. And this is another one.
Shout out to Sigzil for making such a quick life-changing, like life-saving decision. He thinks to himself, we say life-saving, obviously this is very detrimental, but his friend does still exist, at least, and he thinks to himself, he's like, man, I really hope this saving the dead eye Spren thing that Adolin is on is legit, because
yeah,
he's devastated and he wants to fix that as soon as possible. But he did save her, and so that's a huge props to do that so quick and something that was so painful and challenging, you know. Yeah, he's done a great job. Brandon Sanderson has done a great job of making us hate Moash, that's for sure. I'm assuming we're going to get some real poetic justice for Moash in this book, because maybe not. I still have no idea what's going to happen, but I've been expecting some there's got to be a big moment with Moash. Like, we've had moments with Moash, like terrorizing the Bridgemen, but are we going to get that, like, you know, that like a Moash Kaladin duel or something?
I think it's really interesting that Moash in this book has really turned into the Bridge 4 bounty hunter, that Odium has kind of just let him loose on Bridge 4 specifically. And before that, he was kind of just the antagonist working for Odium, you know, killing Elokar, killing what's his face from Hearthstone. I don't remember his name. And, you know, he's kind of just been this antagonist tool for Odium. Teravangian's like, hey, I'll give you some spikes and go for it, dude. I don't care. And so now he's just hunting Bridge 4 specifically on the battlefield, which I think is pretty gnarly.
Well, and you talk about where we're going with this Moash thing. Are we getting a Kaladin Moash duel? Where is this going to end up? I don't know. I do think, though, we talked a lot before this book and going into this book about, are we going to get a Moash redemption arc? And I got to say, 1,100 pages into this book, I don't think we've moved a single millimeter.
Nope.
In that direction.
Nope.
Not the slightest hint that could be a possibility here.
I'd be willing to bet that there are several Moash apologists out there who are quite upset with the way Moash has gone in this book. That there is, you know, some people who are very apologetic to Moash and his circumstances. I bet they're not happy with where Moash has ended up here. I'm not one of them, though.
it does feel like he has fallen off the cliff. There is no coming back, and that what is coming to him is a full on Kaladin beatdown.
He kind of took the Amaram pill of Kaladin antagonist, like had a complex backstory, and then you're right, just kind of jumped off the cliff and is no longer any ounce of redeemable. You're not reading for him at all. So I don't know how I feel about that.
Like more than any other character, like you're going to convince me to root for Odium a lot faster than you are getting me to root for Moash. Like we just had a whole scene where Odium was making a lot of good points and is at least very logical about this. And then you just turn over, look at Moash, and you're like, yeah, he's a villain. Moving on.
Yep. I am making the assumption that Sigzil is not in the back five books. I have made the assumption 2 years ago now that Sigzil is off doing his Sigzil stuff, like the Sunlit Man, and is not on Rashar in the picture at all in the back five. But I also made the assumption that Vienta would be dead for the back five. And now, based on chapter 118, Vienta could be like a pivotal character in the back five with some sort of healing path with Adolin and Maya and stuff. Vienta, like returning to herself as an honor spren, I'd totally be here for that if that was a story being told. Anything else before a short Adolin bit in 119?
I don't think so. We'll see. I feel like there's still more to go with Sigzil. I think there was still more that, we're kind of on the hunt for things because we've read Sunlit Man. I think there's still more that we haven't answered.
Well, I guess we need to talk about the Venli stuff. So Venli jumps under Chasm Fiend, assaults the plateau, Sigzil runs away. That's the whole chapter here. And then Venli... Well, what do you guys think the plan is? I'll just ask that question. I assume the plan is the heroes abandon the plateau, but because Venli is technically in service to the Knights Radiant, then the Knights Radiant still hold the plateau on technicality. That's what I think the plan is. And I think that's why they needed Jasnah, because she needed to like send her a letter that says I'm in service to you or whatever.
And that's what the papers are that Sigzil leaves for her?
She's got a signed stamp from Jasnah that says I work for you. And like she's just gonna hold it in her pocket for 12 hours.
That's way better than anything I was thinking of. I was thinking of Venli's gonna go open the metaphorical back door somewhere and they sneak back in at the last second and we're here.
That's what I thought too, but I think it's gonna be the hey, I serve Jasnah, so this plateau is technically still under like in control and you didn't take it. Haha.
Help me with my radiant power wheel. Venli is a will shaper.
Will shaper, correct.
Her powers are move stone, make stone do flowy things.
Uh-huh.
And what else?
And teleportation, right?
Yeah, she gets the Else Gate.
She chair that so, with the Else Caller.
Okay. This is. I thought it might be that. Is that the plan? Is it she? They lock the Oath Gate, can't get through. Yada yada. But then surprise, she's gonna Else Gate them back.
What if she Else Gates the plateau away? Like she picks up the stone and like Else Gates it away.
She can like shape the stone thing. That'd be an interesting combo of her powers.
Yep. She's like, nope. My plateau.
Sorry, if that, can't reach it. Oh, can't get it. Oh, nope. Try again. Oh, nope. See?
Correct. So here now. If that's not the solution, I'm going to be disappointed now. That better be the solution. Okay. Adolin is chilling with one leg and May and Yonagon playing towers. And the title of the chapter is called The Sunmaker's Gambit. And it's a decently lengthy scene of Yonagon genuinely holding his own, playing towers here, and then figuring out why he's still lost, because Mei and Adolin were weaker than he was, but they teamed up to become stronger than him. All that to say, how does that apply to Aesir? Why are we being told this? Is this, am I overthinking this, and this is just a tower scene, or is there going to be some like two lesser forces ganging up on the bigger force that's about to play here in Aesir? I don't know.
I've been wrestling with, we're still showing a lot of Yonagon development. I love Yonagon. I think it's been really fun to journey and see and teach and learn alongside Yonagon in this book. And I'm wondering when the payoff is going to be, or what the point is going to be at the end. We see this scene and I was taking it as basically just another tower scene. Yonagon is learning things, the premise of, yeah, okay, if you're in a big, not a 1v1 battle, but there's three parties, you don't want to be the one to first expend your resources. You know, like that was my takeaway. that was like, okay, awesome. Yeah, I'll note that and move forward. I assume that these lessons are going to pay off, but I don't know. We've had that, and we've had a lot. All of our epigraphs, by the way, are prologue or from, what was it? Principles of Towers and War. Yeah,
Proverbs of Towers and
Proverbs
War.
Proverbs of Towers and War. So we're really all in on this Towers game.
Yeah.
So
we will be reading all of our epigraphs to start next episode.
Ooh, exciting.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems kind of late in the game to apply all this, and it also doesn't seem that Aesir really has a way out here, but we will go find out. Anything else, gentlemen?
Yeah, I don't know quite how to apply those notes or thoughts or what they're getting at there, but we'll see. Brandon tends to work in a lot of details into some very complex closures of his plot lines, so it will not surprise me one bit if all of these Towers lessons come to fruition or application in our real world events.
Okay. We can reconvene next week with chapters 120 through 125, the end of day 9 next week. Thanks for joining me, Paul and Elliot.
Toodaloo.
Toodles.